This is Baalbek in the Lebanon, undoubtedly a Roman temple here. Temple of Jupiter that I'm sitting in, and behind it the Temple of Bacchus, dedicated to wine. Those Romans knew how to have fun. A Roman site for sure, but what about this bizarre enclosure wall that surrounds it, which is totally separate from the Temple of Jupiter? What's this about? This is called the Trilithon. Each of these three blocks weighs 900 tons. 900 tons. And it's extraordinary the way they're built into a wall and raised 30 feet above the ground like this, a wall the provenance for which has not been established by archaeology. Just another look, and I'm in the picture for scale at the Trilithon. So nearby is the quarry. And the quarry contains a number of very large blocks that were never transported from the quarry site. Now, the one I'm standing on weighs 1,000 tons, 100 tons more than the ones in that wall. And that one over there, on the other side of the road, unfortunately used now as a rubbish tip, weighs 1,200 tons. And the one here in the that I'm standing on here, which is only recently excavated, turns out to weigh 1,400 tons. Why only recently excavated? Because the whole site was covered in sedimentation. What archaeologists say, and it still amuses me, of course the Romans did everything. They found they could move 900-ton blocks, but 1,000 tons was too much for them. So they couldn't move them. So they just left them in the quarry. In my view, that's a very un-Roman thing to do. The Romans were very practical people. Okay, let's say they couldn't move 1,000 tons, but having gone to all the work of creating huge megaliths like this, they wouldn't have wasted them. They'd have sliced them up like loaves of bread and used the already shaped blocks in other constructions. The fact that they didn't do that, that these are still there, suggests to me the whole site was covered during Roman times, and it's only in more recent times that it's been excavated and revealed. And then let's go to Sacsayhuaman in the Sacred Valley near the town of Cuzco in Peru, in the high Andes. Incredible megaliths there, which archaeology gives entirely to the Incas, even though the Incas themselves recognized and honored the work of predecessors. Archaeology gives this work entirely to the Incas. I mean, that's me, for scale, standing beside that block. And look at these weird sort of holes in the block and the way the blocks are almost fitted, melted together in a very strange manner. It's very different from what is definitely Inca architecture. I'll just show a few more shots. These sort of scallops in the side of the block, these holes, it almost looks like the stone was soft and that people were pressing something into it. Maybe it raises the question, was there a way of manipulating and even melting stone, putting it in place? The work is very fine. I mean, you can't get a razor blade between the joints in the blocks. It's just incredibly fine megalithic work. And I was privileged to spend... I've had several visits to the Andes with Jesus Gamara, who himself is a descendant of the Incas and who is a local researcher following in the footsteps of his father, who also was intensely interested in the megaliths. And he and his father are both confident, absolutely confident, that the Incas simply were latecomers and that they rebuilt, they built on top of, they modified, they honored by overbuilding the much older structures that are the megalithic structures. And here we are at Pisac, and Jesus is showing me different aspects of the site, and at Sacsayhuaman, and explaining his view that actually there's evidence for three cultures there, the Incas being the last, and that there were two earlier cultures. And he believes that the megalithic work is entirely the work of these earlier cultures and has been wrongly handed to his ancestors, the Incas. And weirdly, up there near Cuzco, we have this curious stonework, and we also have it at Alakahoyuk in Turkey. Exactly the same kind of thing. Is this a coincidence, or is there something going on behind the scenes of history that we've not been fully informed about yet. And oddly, these patterns, these T-shaped pillars that we see at Göbekli Tepe are repeated at the Temple of Edfu in Upper Egypt and also in Peru. Let's go to Tiwanaku, even higher in the Andes. We're now 14,000 feet above sea level. And this 300-ton block, God knows how anybody got it up there at 14,000 feet above sea. I can even breathe at 14,000 feet above sea level. It takes me days to get acclimatized. This massive megalithic site in Tiwanaku. And some curiosities. There's these H-shaped blocks. We recognize them as an H because H is a letter in our alphabet. That's, of course, not what they meant to the ancients, but it's the shape I want to draw attention to. Because that same shape appears at Göbekli Tepe. It appears on the belts of some of the figures. Now, I'm not saying that people from Göbekli Tepe brought that idea to the Americas. I suspect it more likely the other way around, actually. What I'm saying is that there appears to be an iconographic connection between the two sites, which is not explained by current theories of archaeology. Tiwanaku is a very controversial site, and archaeologists would like it not to be much more than 2,000 years old. But there's curious astronomical alignments at Tiwanaku, which make it clear that the site was aligned to the summer solstice in 10,500 BC, 12,500 years ago. And this is because the rising point of the sun on the solstice changes as a result of shifts in the obliquity of the Earth's axis over a 41,000-year cycle. Tiwanaku makes much more sense as 12,500 years old from an astronomical point of view than it does as 2,000 years old. Some other figures here. The ones on the right, starting here, are all from Tiwanaku. But over here we have the god Osiris from Egypt, a bearded figure, remembered by the ancient Egyptians as a bringer of the gifts of civilization, not only in Egypt, but in many other lands as well. And down here we have the earliest surviving representation of the feathered serpent, Quetzalcoatl, in Mexico, from the Olmec culture. And again, Quetzalcoatl is remembered in traditions from Central America as a bringer of civilization and as a teacher of civilization. So let's move over now to Tiwanaku. There's this pillar in the so-called semi-subterranean chamber. And on the front of the pillar is this face, which is the face of a deity venerated in the Andes for millennia. And the name of that deity is Viracocha. Notice the heavy beard on the figure here and here. There's a serpent on the side of the pillar. And up here, you can't see it clearly, is a curious animal. We've highlighted it here, this curious creature. And what it looks like is an extinct example of South American megafauna. It looks a lot like Toxodon, which went extinct at the end of the Ice Age. What's it doing on this pillar if the site is only 2,000 years old? Then there's another problem. Okay, I suggest strongly that evidence for much earlier megalithic construction is hiding in plain view and has been misdated by archaeology. But there's a far greater problem that's posed by the huge areas of the Earth where only minimal archaeological investigations have ever been carried out. Well, the Sahara Desert, for example. Yes, there's been some archaeology in the Sahara Desert, but not very much. I get it. It's a very expensive place to work. It's a very tough place to work. And besides, archaeology has the view that there's not much to find there. There has been some archaeology done, but very, very little. Minimal. That's 9.2 million square kilometers of the Earth's surface that hasn't yet really been studied by archaeology at all. It's around about the size of the Republic of China. It's like talking about the world and excluding China completely from the story. We can't say we've got the past completely nailed down when we haven't thoroughly investigated the Sahara Desert. Because the Sahara Desert was green during the Ice Age. It wasn't how it looks today. It was a fertile area for many periods during the Ice Age. And oddly enough, there are ancient maps copied from even older source maps, which show river channels in the Sahara and lakes. And weirdly, recent surveys have demonstrated that there was a river channel exactly where indicated on that mysterious ancient map. Here's Antarctica as it looks today. Well, this map was drawn in 1813. It's the Pinkerton World Map, and it's based on the latest science available in 1813. It's a really good map where it comes to South America and South Africa and Australia. But as you will observe, something's missing from the picture. Antarctica isn't there. Why isn't Antarctica there? Because it's an honest map. They hadn't discovered it in 1813. They didn't discover it until 1820. So it's very odd, in my view, that Antarctica appears on much older source maps, which themselves are based on even older source maps. It's interesting, this little legend down here, I've had it translated. Behold clearly to you, O reader, Orontius Phineus Delphinates offers with elegant appearance a geography not so far seen and accurately engraved, which in fact preserves the shape and form of the human heart. And take care that it should be at heart for you. And also presents to your eye provinces, islands, seas, rivers, mountains, not so far seen nor known to some of the great map papers of antiquity, Ptolemy, Eudoxius, Aristophanes, Macrobius. And we're told that these areas lay in darkness until this map was drawn. I suggest they lay in darkness because they were on the much older source maps that Orontius Phineus and other map makers drew upon, source maps that came out into public circulation from about the 1400s, 1300s onwards, probably taken from Constantinople. And then what about the area of the world that was covered by rising sea levels at the end of the Ice Age? This is another area where very little archaeology has been done. We are talking about 27 million square kilometers. That's roughly equivalent in size to China, the US, and Europe, all added together, that were above water during the Ice Age and that were submerged at the end of the Ice Age. Again, I'll come to those ancient maps. On the left, we have Southeast Asia in 1507 and as it looks today. And on the right, we have an inundation map showing Southeast Asia and Australia as they looked 21,300 years ago when sea level was 400 feet lower than they are today. As you can see, what today is an archipelago of islands and the Malaysian Peninsula was a huge subcontinent-sized landmass. New Guinea was joined to Australia at that time. And it's interesting that this other mysterious map, again drawn from older source maps, seems to depict the Sunda Shelf as it looked during the last Ice Age. So this map is showing present land masses and the sunken land masses that were submerged at the end of the Ice Age. The Sunda Shelf is particularly interesting. We now know that it was highly fertile, highly attractive land during the Ice Age. So you didn't really want to spend a lot of time in the far northern hemisphere during the Ice Age. You wanted to get down near the equator. That was the best, warmest land on Earth. And this would have been a fantastic place for people to settle and for civilizations to evolve. And that's why I'm so interested, and we depicted it in Ancient Apocalypse, this work by geologist Danny Hillman Natarajan at Gunung Padang on the island of Java. And I'm suggesting, and Danny believes, that this site is originated more than 20,000 years ago. It may have been added to by later cultures. It's still venerated today, but it's a very, very old site in his view. It was one of those high areas that was above water, that remained above water even after sea level rose at the end of the Ice Age. It's on the island of Java, but that island of Java was connected to Sumatra and Borneo and the Malaysian Peninsula when the Sunda Shelf was above water. So, Sahara Desert, 9 million square kilometers, 27 million square kilometers submerged at the end of the Ice Age, the best real estate on Earth. Is marine archaeology being done? Yes, it is. Marine archaeology is being done. It does exist. It's very expensive, and not a lot of it is done. But when I saw this headline, I thought, I've got somebody on my side. archaeologist explains why we need to look underwater to understand the past. But then the explanation is so disappointing because what he's looking for is shipwrecks from the 16 and 1700s. And that's primarily what all marine archaeology is about. It's changing now. It's changing slowly. We know about Doggerland as a result, and archaeologists are beginning to look at it. But my point is that the vast area that was submerged during the end of the Ice Age has never been studied by archaeology at all. And they're not in a position to say that they know that there's no possibility of a lost civilization during the Ice Age, while they haven't investigated those 27 million, when they haven't investigated the Sahara Desert. Well, Santa and I decided to do some investigation of our own underwater. And actually, we spent the best part of 10 years scuba diving all over the world, following up tales and traditions from local divers and fishermen looking for structures underwater. And here at Ponape, the well-known site of Nan Madol, we followed up the advice of local divers, and we went underwater. And we find that the site doesn't just stop there. It continues underwater, and at first it continues with the same kind of construction that you see above water. But as you go deeper, as you get down to about 27 meters underwater, you start seeing structures that are completely different, these huge pillars underwater. A fallen pillar here, which is very interesting because it so closely resembles the pillars of Tinian in nearby area of the Pacific. Micronesia, and this is Tinian, and I'm suggesting again that that pillar underwater suggests to us that Tinian megalith may be much older than we're told. That's my fins disappearing through a tunnel underwater in Japan. Santa and I did more than 200 dives around this site. It's called Yonaguni, and I'm going to show you why I believe archaeologists are wrong. Archaeologists who've never dived there, who wouldn't even contemplate diving there. Diving at Yonaguni is really dangerous. There's a massive current there. You get swept away. If you try and stop and examine the structure, you end up fighting the sea. And believe me, you don't want to fight the sea. When the sea sends a current your way, the best thing you can do is just go with it and drift, and that's great fun. But you try to hang on to a structure, and the sea's going to beat you up badly. That's the edges of that tunnel. And as you can see, it's a megalithic tunnel with one block piled on top of the other. And then at the end of the tunnel, we see this. Two blocks positioned side by side. And that's me just diving down beside those blocks to show their nature and their scale. They're enormous. And archaeologists say, oh, no problem. They must have fallen from some cliff overhead. The only problem is there is no cliff overhead. And never has been. So those two blocks, this is them in context. There they are. That tunnel that I went through is down here. There's the two blocks. And then there's this massive, completely natural stone outcropping. I'm not disputing that it's natural. But as we continue to explore that outcropping, what do we find? We find a flat terrace. And we find steps on the terrace. And in my mind, this speaks strongly of human workmanship. Japan is a megalithic culture. Many of the megaliths in Japan have never really been properly studied. This one is called Masado no Iwafuna, the upside-down boat stone the Asuka area of Japan. It's interesting that if you go around to the other side of that huge megalith, you'll see how it was created. They cut out these grooves in it, creating these outcroppings, which, if they'd finished the work, would have been smoothed off and left to look like the rest of the structure. Oddly enough, exactly the same stone-cutting technique is found underwater at Yonaguni. And since it's nearly 30 meters underwater, it's been underwater for more than 12,000 years. Above water in Japan, you do have megalithic stone circles. The one at the top left is from Hokkaido. Aomori on the right, very small river stones used to create a circle. And then Shikoku down at the bottom left. Well, we heard of a site in the Kerama Islands, in the southern part of Japan, where there was a stone circle underwater. Well, we couldn't resist that. So we went diving there. And lo and behold, what did we find? A massive stone circle. And indeed, circles made of small river stones as well. But 30 meters underwater. 12,000 years old plus. What is going on here? Well, that's me with a video camera up there and a diver down there beside the central upright for scale. These megaliths, like the pillars at Karahan Tepe, are carved out of bedrock. They're carved out of bedrock. And it's really difficult for me to see how nature could have done this. I mean, there I am on top of the central upright. Look at the way the outer curve of the central upright matches the inner curve of one of the outer uprights. Here we are now in Taiwan. From that island of Yonaguni, Taiwan is actually visible on a clear day. Here we're underwater with local diver Steve Shear at Taiwan, and he's showing us a wall he discovered underwater, about 20 meters underwater. And that wall has battlements, and it has a kind of plaza in front of it. And unless there's any doubt that it's man-made, let's get up close and look at it. It's made of individual blocks of stone. This doesn't happen naturally. This is a man-made structure underwater, which archaeology has paid absolutely zero attention to. And then what about India? Diving in Indian waters is often quite murky. There's a lot of sediment in the water. Makes it very difficult to see. But here's South India as it looked during the Ice Age, when sea level was much lower. Sri Lanka was joined to South India. And I'm interested in two sites in particular in South India, Pumpahar and Mahabalipuram. Pumpahar we heard about from the National Oceanographic Institute of India. We're based in Goa. And they kindly actually took us diving at Pumpahar and showed us what they are confident is a man-made structure. They describe it as a U-shaped structure at 29 meters underwater. And I apologize for the visibility, but that's what you dive in there. Fishermen get their nets caught on it. Causes trouble to fishermen all the time. In fact, they would like it removed. And there are individual blocks surrounding it. Further north at Mahabalipuram, Busantha and I, who investigated this area first. Santha speaks the Tamil language as her first language. And so we were able to communicate easily and fluently with local fishermen. And we asked them at Mahabalipuram, is there anything underwater that you guys know about? And they said, yeah, there's a whole city out there. And we're really annoyed about it because we keep catching our nets on it and we have to send down divers, and they're not scuba divers, free divers. And sometimes they get killed. And we've asked the government to do something about it, but they don't believe us. Well, we believe them. It took about 2 years to organize the expedition. And we had to involve the Scientific Exploration Society led by John Blashford Snell in Britain. As you can see, it was a very high-tech expedition. And off we went, diving off the waters of Mahabalipuram. And immediately, we saw the fishermen were right, that there are man-made structures underwater, two blocks side by side here. A bit of a wall sticking above the sand, a wall with a standout feature. There I'm putting my dive knife into the gap between two blocks. Another pair of blocks there, and a curved feature. There's so much more underwater at Mahabalipuram. Well, following that investigation, it was decided that some archaeology would be done. But to my frustration, the archaeology so far has been confined to the intertidal zone, just down to 5 meters. And they haven't been down to 27 to 30 meters where we found these structures yet.